This is September 8, 2008, and we're continuing our conversation with Gerard Stern, a poet of communications and many other things. Gerard, we finished the Intermedia story in Cambridge, and now you start working the cheese business. Depending on how much you want to go into it, there's a lot on the Bancroft College site about the details that happened. It's up to you how much you want to go into it, maybe talk about what you learned from it personally, because the big issue was your father in that thing, it seemed. Do you want to talk about that? We haven't talked much about your father other than what happened at the beginning of your life.
Well, I mean, what happened was, I don't remember how we finished Intermedia. I don't know if we went into the bankruptcy and all that, which was kind of a big hassle. But anyway,
we did touch on that.
Yeah, and anyway, what happened was that my brother, who had kind of taken the helm of the cheese business, which was called Otto Stern, and later on Otto Stern and Son, and even later Otto Stern and Sons, incorporated. It wasn't incorporated until my brother came along, because my father didn't believe in stuff like that. But, my brother needed help. My father was getting very old. I mean, he was over 80 by this time. And it seemed like the right thing to do. The other possibility was I was offered a job taking over the television, experimental television art lab at WBGO, but, you know, that meant raising money mostly, and it wasn't something that I really felt like I was very good at doing.
You said WGBO, you mean WGBH?
GBH,
yeah. So the, is this?
Fred Barzyk was getting ready to let go of that, but,
Now, what, how, is this 1978, 79, 80? Is it still
probably
the 70s?
Probably, yeah.
Okay, so your father was born around 1898 or something.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, he died at 95, about 12 years ago, with the Sholem, and, he was, an interesting, special kind of person. He wasn't very nice. He was kind of mean, especially to his kids. He could be very charming socially, and he was very well respected in the business as a straight shooter. There were aspects of him that were totally straight, but they weren't particularly public. And my brother, when I joined the company, because there were certain incentives, we were kind of threw up in Boston area. And
this is your stepbrother?
Yeah, Raymond, my half brother, and I have a half sister, Marion, too. They were both born in the United States after we arrived here. And he had taken the business in a somewhat different direction. He incorporated it. He moved it to New Jersey from downtown New York. He associated with a lot of people that my father hadn't been associated with, and in a sense he was pretty smart, but he was kind of lazy, and there were a lot of people, particularly one in the office next to ours, who was doing a lot of the work that should have been done in our office and getting a lot of the profit and proceeds, and he was also kind of suborning our secretary, who he fed some cash. ask for information. And it was kind of a nasty little tricky, and I didn't like it. And, you know, I'm my personality in the cheese business or any kind of business were not perfect matches. And a couple of weeks after I joined the business, and by this time I was commuting and staying in Phil Niblock's loft in New York on the couch. And
Phil Niblock, he became a well-known artist, right? Or maybe it was the time you were with him.
Yeah, he already was. Yeah, filmmaker and composer. Old, you know, very long-term friend of mine, still is a friend of mine. We're both Libras. And until we moved down and my father helped us buy a house here in New Jersey, and so we got ensconced. And
what was Sally doing at the time, your wife?
She was thinking maybe of going back into some kind of social work or education. And she hadn't been working the last years up there. She'd been taking care of Abram. And and one day, very soon after I started work, my father said to me, "Look, Garrett, we're not in business to sell cheese. We're in business to make money." And that kind of describes my orientation altogether, because I love things, you know. I love cheese. I love the cheese a lot more than I love the money, you know. And, how to position myself in the cheese business, because business needs to grow. So I did a few things, you know. I got instead of the kind of solid, continuous customers that my brother favored, because they weren't very much work really, I went out and got customers that took quite a bit of relating to, and found things that they needed and wanted. And at first my father was very critical of it. I invented a new cheese, you know. I mean, creativity is, you know, my bag. I mean, the cheese business is based on our business, importing, on licenses, which are quotas that the United States has, and they're divided into types of cheese, and they're some of them are quite rare. Like, one of our big deals was cheese from Holland, and the Edam and Gouda license was rare, and we never had enough of it. And those two cheeses are either 40% or 48% fat in the dry matter. So I went over to Holland and I persuaded our exporter there, which was a huge company called Frico, to make a cheese which was 45%, which was in a different license category where there was lots of license. And I called it Haldam, Hall for Holland, and Dam because Edam, and, you know, that's a Dutch word. And, in the next few years, it was a huge success. We sold, container loads. A container of cheese is 40,000 pounds.
Is this all across the states or in the New York area?
Yeah, all across the states. In fact, our biggest sales of Hall Dam were down in the southern states, because there was a big Dutch company that had bought several supermarket chains down there. Anyway, I played as much as I could, and it was interesting. But in the meantime, Abram going to school, and I was supporting my family, and I was doing very little poetry and art, and that was very satisfying to my wife at the time, who, you know, kind of basked in more middle-class existence than I really maybe favored. And when eventually the cheese business fell apart, and it fell apart twice in a row, really, for me, I was catapulted back into poetry and art, so it put me in the place where I am today, where I have very little money, but I have a lot of what in Yiddish is called nachas, which means, you know, pride and satisfaction in what one is doing, happiness.
And recognition and involvement in talking to people of all ages, right?
Yeah, you know, the recognition, I feel, is a little iffy. At present, I have more recognition in Germany than I do in the United States, which is kind of ironic. And the recognition is very nice, but some sales wouldn't be, you know, hard to take. I tend to get more expenses for going places than anything else. I mean, so, you know, living off Social Security and a little dam here and there is not exactly easy.
Right, you say you get your expenses covered when you're invited to go places around the world?
Oh, absolutely. I won't go otherwise.
Right, but the thing is, you're being creative. You're working on an opera or something now.
Yeah, I'm working on 15 different projects. I'm a juggler, you know. And the difference between me and regular jugglers is when I drop something, I figure it's gone, you know.
Yeah.
I don't bother to pick it up because there's so many things still up in the air. Most jugglers have some way of, you know, retrieving objects and getting them back into play. I tend not to do that. But right now, yeah, I got opera. There's a TV art channel in Europe that I want to help get set up in the United States. I am you know, involved in the Intermedia Foundation, which the old USCO church needs funds to maintain and repair. I could go on.
Okay, well, I wanted to go into the Reality Club. Now, was that happening before you got into the cheese business?
Yes, it was happening before I got into the cheese business, but...
Tell us about it. What is that, the Reality Club?
The Reality Club was a gathering which was founded basically by John Brockman, who, you know, I went way back with, as you may remember. He was involved with us at the World, and we did a thing at the Y in New York, and we were supposed to write a book together. Anyway, John, at the beginning it was at his house on Central Park West, and the idea was that the members, except for the founding members, which were, you know, not too many of us.
You were a founding member.
I think I would call myself a founding member. I don't know what John would call me.
Was it connected? What was the book that came out? I have copies of them, but not here. We talked about in the early 70s. The text. The reality text, or what was that called?
Not the reality text, but...
Ed helped make it. Ed Rosenthal.
It was
Okay, real time. The Reality Club is not connected to that.
Well, you might say it was connected to it. Real time was a project that Ed and John were involved in the literary end of it, and I was supposedly involved in making videotapes for the Real Time. And I did some, and I think there was one of Marshall. I'm not sure. I know there was one of Ned, you know who I mean, out of New Mexico.
Ned, not Ned Rorm.
The silent language and the hidden.
Oh, Ted Hall. Ed Hall? Edmund, what's his name? Ed Hall,
Ned,
the silent language.
Hall. Yes.
Yes, Edward Hall, I guess. Edward T. And Hall.
A lot of people in the kind of scientific, intellectual community, black and white half-inch tapes with a Sony Portapak, which was the first little video thing that came out, which we bought, John.
So you and John were doing those?
I was doing the video, and John and Ed were doing the magazines. I think the only two of them came out. I think I have the first two.
Yeah, as far as I know, there's only two, and in the back there's a picture of you, and you were supposed to go around and maybe do colleagues' lectures promoting it or promoting it or creating the network.
That never happened. Anyway, the idea was that people who talked to the club became members, but they had to talk about some of their work, which was new, preferably not yet published, and it was put up against the rest of the members for a comment, for criticism, positive and negative.
Almost like a peer review.
Yeah, exactly. And as I said, for the first long, long time, it was in John's house.
Can you name some of the people who were founders or at the beginning? Was you? Was Ed Rosenfeld there?
No, he wasn't. Ed wasn't a member. Heinz Pagels and his wife.
Who dies, you know, mountain climbing or something. Heinz Pagels, right?
I think you might more call it mountain falling.
And his wife did one of the major introductory texts on Gnosticism or something.
Sure, the Dead Sea Chronicles, right?
Dead Sea Scrolls? Did you do a
book? Dead Sea Scrolls, right. That was her book.
Elaine Pagels, right.
Yeah, Elaine, right.
So Heinz was there.
Yes, and Heinz later became the president. And we did a big memorial for him when he died. But anyway, that was later, because by that time we were meeting in the Rockefeller boardroom. Heinz was teaching there, but I met people, early on, like Ralph Abraham.
Yeah.
Who's talked to us. And
did William Irwin Thompson speak to you?
Yeah, I believe Bill Thompson did. And,
Gregory Bateson?
I don't know that Gregory. I knew Gregory, of course, but I don't think Gregory was around.
Because
it was a brilliant venue. Let's put it that way, and it lasted and lasted and lasted until after Heinz died, and then by that time, John, it had a kind of ambivalent, there were people like Frank Gillette and Paul Ryan, and,
Let me say this, I know that Brockman, according maybe to William Irwin Thompson, who had met Brockman at around Esalen, late 60s, early 70s, and Brockman started to be the literary agent for people, Fritjof Capra or people like that.
Yeah, well, Fritjof talked to us, yeah.
Yeah, and so he was looking, on a practical level, he was looking for new scientific writers.
I was just going to say that. It was kind of ambivalent. It was this peer review group, but on the other hand, John was building his client base.
Yes, yeah. And he'd carved out this.
And he did a very, very good job of it. And he's now, probably the leading, not only in the U.S., but maybe, in Western world, literary agent. And he has a penthouse in Midtown, New York, and he's previous generation.
Literary agent.
Yes. Big-time guy.
A big what?
A big-time literary agent.
Yeah. And the...
So she learned the business, and John...
had some assistance.
Osmosis did it. But he's very good. I mean, one day John and I had lunch, and I told him that story about we're not in business to sell cheese, we're in business to make money. And John said, "Oh my God, is he ever right?" And you know what he did the very next day? He raised his percentage. The percentage that people made in those days was 15%, right?
Mm-hmm.
Agents. He doubled it.
and
nobody objected. And then he invented the auction. You know, the ethics of the literary agent business was that you offered it to one publisher at a time, right?
Yeah.
You didn't go to more than one. I mean, that wasn't Infradig. Hey, John put things up for auction, and I introduced him to Stuart Brand, and he auctioned off Stuart's Whole Earth catalog, which was one of his biggest early sales.
Yeah, that's about 1969.
And made Stuart a heap of money. And Stuart, you know, came out of us, and Stuart never... kind of paid. Never mind. not a great relationship later on.
Right, but the thing is that the whole catalog is 69. You're saying he auctioned that, but you're talking about the cheese business. Weren't you told that 10 years later by your father, or he had said it years before? I mean, just talking about the chronology here. If you're telling John to do that, and then he does, he raises his agent.
Hey, I can't tell you.
Okay, but the Reality Club is happening in the mid-70s, and people are coming, and he's finding writers that he can publish. And he carves out this sort of, quote, new age science, or leading edge science kind of books.
Right.
Yeah, he was William Irwin Thompson's agent. I remember Bill telling me that. Don't know when that started.
I don't know either.
So when you move to, you say, the Rockefeller boardroom of what, Rockefeller Center?
Rockefeller boardroom. Actually, before that, we were at that school down in the village. We moved from John's house to that school.
New School of Social Research?
No. You know, for younger kids, not colleges.
Okay, so you had a classroom?
No, we had a good-sized meeting room. I don't know. It's not the little red schoolhouse, but it's, you know, a really upmarket school, which was with very good reputation. And the dean or the principal had spoken to us, and he offered us that. And because it grew, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it was a small circle, and it grew. And slowly, people like I and Paul and Frank were kind of on the periphery, and people like Isaac Asimov and, you know, and people, and the guy who did the fractals and, you know.
Mandelbrot.
It became much more important.
I have three or four books, collections of lectures of the Reality Club. You know, John even marketed the transcripts of talks. I have those books, Reality Club books. So
the kind of the last one, which was, I think, after the club was already no longer extant, was the Digerati.
Yes, yeah. But he moved into creating the website called The Edge.
Yeah.
And that's a continuation of it.
Right.
In web
terms. Now, in the last few years, we've had a completely different set of talks called Poetry Science Talks, which you were involved in the inception of.
That's with Neil?
Neil and Ed.
Right. But okay, going back, though, you're in the cheese business, but do you make sure you get to every lecture? Are you making it a regular thing in your life?
Well, not every lecture. I spoke at several of them, and the most important one was the only time that we went out of town. We went to San Francisco, and the night before I flew, and on the plane, I wrote this poem called Poem Think.
Poem Think.
Think, Poem Think, which is about thinking of poetry and not writing it down.
Yeah.
It's really a rather brilliant poem, if I do say so myself.
Yeah.
And I read it in San Francisco right after Rollo May spoke, and just before I got on stage, Stuart Brand came up to me and he said, "Garrett, I'm sure this will be an interesting poem that you're reading, but I think I'll go sunbathe out on the at the beach instead," which is very, very Stuart, right?
Yeah.
He had to open his big fat mouth. I mean, he couldn't just do it, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, after I read the poem, Heinz von Forster got up from the audience and he said, "This poem is exactly what our young cyberneticians and scientists of all kinds need to understand and think about, because what it is it provides a process of insight. And I want to publish this poem in the Cybernetic Review," which he did.
Great.
Of course, the Cybernetic Review only had a few issues because it never kind of got going.
Yeah.
But he published in the same issue a fantastic essay, To Know and to Let Know, something that he had delivered to the American Library Association. And so I was very happy. I mean, it was a lot better to have it published in Cybernetic Review than in a poetry magazine.
Right. What's this phrase, Tolodnoy? That was the title of Forster's essay?
To Know and to Let Know.
Oh.
I mean, I have copies of it.
That's your thing.
No, that's his thing. My thing was Poem Think.
Okay, gotcha.
You never got a copy?
No.
Just email me your snail mail address and I'll send it to you.
Okay. Now, can you give me a... Is this the 80s or early 90s when that's happening?
No, it's earlier than that.
Okay.
Let me see when the
publication...
The publication wasn't until maybe even a year or two after, but that publication was in, right here, 1985.
Oh, okay.
So it must have been, you're probably right, it was early 80s.
Right, and that point, that was a one unique time on San Francisco, but you are doing it in the Rockefeller...
Yeah,
boardroom or something. But what is that, Rockefeller Center, do you mean?
No, Rockefeller University.
Oh, okay.
Over on the east side.
Yes. So that's the late 70s, early 80s. And you know how, was John thinking of it as multidisciplinary or really
yes.
mainly just science?
No, multidisciplinary. We had people like Alan Burstyn.
Yeah.
And, we had my old friend, who...
Ellen Burstyn's the actress.
Yes. And my old friend, the actor and former artist...
Dennis Hopper.
Dennis, yeah.
Yeah.
And Dennis was so smashed that he couldn't even talk. We had to take him out.
Yeah, that's the middle 80s when he was a coke addict. But the thing is, it's actually, he redid McLuhan's Culture and Technology Seminar. That's what he did.
Well, Okay.
And he did it in New York, so he could get published with these people. So.
Yeah, yeah. Right. It was a really upmarket venue networking thing that he pushed himself very, very, very well.
Right. He became a gatekeeper, a switchboard, and he did that. He's still doing it 30 years.
Yep.
For 30
yep.
years. Though he started with you as a businessman, you know.
And his son is in it, his wife is in it, and she's also now doing digital art of flowers, which is quite remarkable.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Tinka Madsen.
Yes.
Harold Madsen was her father.
How would you spell Madsen? M-A-T-S-E-N?
S-O-N.
S-O-N. So the... did you keep going to Reality Club into the 90s? Does it go in? Does it go on for a long time?
I don't know when it... No, it's kind of folded after Heinz died.
Because he was a important friend?
He was the president.
Oh, he was the president. And
John made him the president. At first, it was a joke.
It was a joke at first, and he was one of the original people.
I don't know about original, but soon thereafter. I think Elaine was first and then Heinz.
Right, and Elaine was with you in John's apartment in the early days.
Yes.
A side note, Phil Neublock, who was born October 2nd, 1933, composer, filmmaker, videographer, and director of experimental intermedia, using the word you coined.
Well, Elaine Summers, who was a dancer, called me after we had Intermedia Foundation, and she said, she was a friend. We did work together, but she said, Garrett, I'm putting a foundation together. Do you have any problem if we call it Experimental Intermedia Foundation? And I said, no, why would I have a problem? You know, and so she did. And she ran it for a while, and then she and the guy that she was living with, the video guy, Davidson Gigliotti, moved down to Florida, and somehow Phil wound up taking over that foundation.
Okay. Oh, was he a friend of Elaine back then, way back there?
Yeah. We all knew Elaine. You know, those were the days of the Judson
Church.
Dance thing.
Carolee Schneeman.
Carolee and, you know.
Was Judd Yelkut part of that scene?
Judd was part of our scene. He and Phil never got along. You know, he was a little too ego-bound for a lot of the people. He hung out.
You mean Phil or Judd?
Judd
was ego.
Phil is not like that.
Oh, okay.
No, Judd still is, but he hung out with Nam June quite a lot because he kind of used Nam June, and with Kasama, you know, the Fluxus crowd.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You just mentioned somebody I wanted to.
Yoko Ono.
No, Phil and oh yeah, Judd. It's Judd. It's his review of Brockman's book that was a product of you two not doing your book together, the book called By the Late John Brockman, which came out in 69, which would be around the time the Whole Earth Catalog comes out, if it's the first one that you're talking about that was the big hit, the one with the picture of the moon shot, right?
Uh-huh.
Shot of the Earth. So Judd Yelkut reviewed that for the East Village Other, and that's when I first heard of Judd John Brockman. So Judd... said that book was tremendous, gave it a great review, but Judd goes off and becomes a professor in the Midwest or someplace. When I met him, that's what he was doing. Remember, you know, I think he did that pretty quickly,
yeah,
right?
He's still living there.
Right. So there was another point there. So this Okay, I can't remember where that was going to go with that, but Heinz Pagels died July 23rd, 1988.
Really?
Yeah, so that...
Okay, so it was right after that that the Real Adelaide Club really stopped. Maybe there may have been one or two after that. I'm not even sure if there were any. Because I remember we did his memorial in a big venue in New York. And
a lot of people came to that.
Yeah.
But this is now that, in 89, a year later.
It wasn't not just the Reality Club people, but, he was a well-known cosmologist.
Yeah. No, he was a big figure.
He was the figurehead of the Rockefeller, whatever that part of the university foundation was. What science, something?
But it was.
He published some fairly popular books.
Yeah, it
did. Elaine did also. They had a child who was who had many, many problems. And so,
yeah, it says they had a son, Mark, who died in 1987 after 4 years of illness.
Right, and. Of course, after Heinz died, Elaine was left with the child, and it was really rather rough for her.
Well, the son, Mark, died in 87, so another child. He was left with another child.
No, I don't think so.
No, this is Wikipedia, may be wrong. I mean, he dies in 88, and the son dies in 87.
I'm not sure. I don't think the son was still alive.
Okay. The book titles he did, The Cosmic Code in 1982, Perfect Symmetry
right.
in 1985, and The Dreams of Reason, subtitled The Rise of the Sciences of Complexity, which becomes a buzzword in the 90s, Sciences of Complexity, so he was on the vanguard of that.
He was very German, you know.
Yeah. And the thing is, also it says President of the International League for Human Rights, so I guess he was an activist. But the thing is that he dies, so the Reality Club winds down in 89, but in 89 the world, quote, changes, right? The wall goes down, and it's a whole new world, and the virtual reality becomes a buzzword, and the beginnings of the Internet start. And John Brockman has to adjust to that. And, of course, a lot of the people that he had promoted were able to write books about, like Howard Rheingold and these people. They were...
What's his name at MIT?
Negroponte?
Marvin Minsky.
Minsky.
Negroponte, probably. I don't know if Negroponte was a client of John's. I'm not sure. But Minsky certainly was.
Yeah, so all these people who were into artificial intelligence and cybernetics were associated with the Reality Club, so it was actually their decade, the 90s, in terms of him getting book contracts for these guys. And, you have Pagels' book, The Science of Complexity. That's the same area. It says here, according to Michael Crichton, the famous novelist, Pagels' work in chaos theory inspired the character Ian Malcolm in his novel Jurassic Park. So Pagels inspired that.
I don't know.
If I click on Elaine Pagels, did she marry again?
I believe so. I haven't seen her in years.
It says, in April 87, Pagel's son Mark died after 5 years of illness. In July 88, her husband died in a mountain climbing accident. These personal tragedies deepened her spiritual awareness and led Pagels to begin the research leading to the book, The Origin of Satan. This book argues that the figure of Satan became a way for Orthodox Christians to demonize their religious opponents, namely other Christian sects and Jews. Her New York Times bestseller, Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas, 2003, focuses on religious claims to possessing the ultimate truth. In it, Pagels contrasts the Gospel of Thomas with the Gospel of John and argues that a close reading of the work shows that while the Gospel of John emphasizes that Jesus is the light of the world, in quotes, the Gospel of Thomas teaches individuals that, quote, there is a light within each person, and it lights up the whole universe. If it does not shine, there is darkness. And it also includes the book, Pagel's Personal Exploration of the Meaning of Loss and Tragedy. So that is, she's probably, John's probably her agent, or was at some point, right?
Yes, he was.
Okay, so the, what are you doing in the 90s for intellectual stimulation? You had the Reality Club. And was that the only, quote, stimulus you were getting since you weren't in the art world at that point? You were doing the cheese business? Or were you reading yourself anyways?
I don't know. I mean, I was traveling a lot to Argentina, and I was traveling to Europe, and, you know, I was taking care of the family and growing up Abram. You know, there was plenty of stimulation that may not have been of the same kind.
And in some ways, you were ambivalent about the whole art world anyways. That's why you went into the cheese business, wasn't it? That was partly the disillusion from the intermediate world.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the intermediate world was business also.
Yeah.
But right, it was kind of a transition, and it was, you know, looking back, it made sense, but it wasn't, excuse me, it wasn't exactly what I might have done if I'd thought a little harder about it.
You mean intermedia?
That too.
Oh, are you referring to the cheese business then?
Yes.
I see. Looking back, you might not have taken so many years in it.
Well, I might not have gone into it at all. I mean, it just seemed like, you know, back to the family and, you know, blah, blah, blah. It seemed like maybe rational, but it didn't turn out to be rational.
it may have seemed irrational, and it didn't turn out to be.
No, it may have seemed rational.
Turned out irrational. Because just to go back to your father, the attempt to do something with him kind of failed in terms of him responding to your effort to harmonize with him.
Well,
he still blamed you for everything. he couldn't see what you were really doing.
He wasn't really changing his, you know, personality. On the other hand, I was, you know, I was effective, and whether he liked it or not. But then my brother got totally greedy, and partially because of his wife, who was from Denmark, and who, for some reason, got
the consumer bug.
Yeah, and he started, you know, some getting involved in some very bad practices.
So that got in real trouble. I don't know if you want to get into it, but you almost ended up in jail.
That's right.
And your lawyer, not his, got you guys out of it.
That's true.
So, I mean, they can read about it in the Bancroft College. You don't want to go into it. Because,
well, I mean, if you have some questions, I don't mind answering them. the upshot of it is that my brother Raymond tried to sue me and the University of California, because he said there was libel, and the attorneys gave him a certain amount of time to prove the libel or to just even cite it, and he never was able to, because there was no libel. In fact, I thought I was pretty easy on it.
Right now. The main thing was that he was being lazy, he was doing some illegal importation, and he thought he could get away with it, and then finally the Customs Service busted him.
That's right.
And he
got turned in by some people in Europe who discovered what was going on. The customs people, it was kind of ironic, because the customs people thought that that we were evading duties. But that's because they didn't understand the regulations. You can't evade duties because no matter where you bring cheese from, it's the same duty amount. However, what the company was doing was bringing in cheese under licenses from one country when the cheese was actually from another country.
Yes, and because he never hid the paperwork on the illegal level, when the customs guys busted your offices, they found all the evidence.
That's right.
You were screwed. There's no way out of it.
You're absolutely right.
So then you're going to jail, and he had a stupid lawyer?
Well, it's a little more complex than that. The Importers Association has a big lawyer, and when Raymond went and told him what had happened, he said, "Oh, well, you know, we have a friend who's a young criminal lawyer, and he's brilliant." But unfortunately, the brilliant kid was too brilliant and too much of a smartass, and the prosecutor, federal prosecutor, this assistant, of course, not a major guy, was a Puerto Rican, and he didn't like this little wise-ass Jewish kid from Long Island. And the kid came to us and said, "Hey, you guys, it's much easier if you just go to jail, because otherwise you're never going to win this case." Now, when George Walker came along...
And how did you know him? How did
George
you get him?
George and I were good friends for, I don't know, 20, 30 years.
From San Francisco?
Yeah. He was the head of the criminal bar in California, the association, and he's a very famous criminal lawyer, and he's over 6 feet tall. He's older than I am. He's black, and very handsome, basketball player when he was young.
You mean a professional ball player?
Basketball, and
beg your pardon?
No, I think college.
College,
and,
yeah.
And,
in basketball, you're saying?
Drove a Rolls Royce, handmade suits, really lovely guy.
Yeah.
We're still friends, by the way. When he went and talked to the prosecutor, it was a whole different trip. We wound up having to pay fines and probation, but it was a lot easier, but my brother still misbehaved badly.
Right, and you were put on, you had to pay, what was the thing you had to pay?
I had to pay $100,000, he had to pay $500,000. I paid $10,000 for 10 years.
Did he pay his?
He must have.
The interesting thing is, people were listening to the person who then becomes president of the American Cheese Society. That's you, Kurt.
Well.
How does that happen? After having your business getting a bad reputation, or your firm?
Well, I don't know. I got involved in the society because of my love for cheese.
Right, and you created your own business. You split off from that, or had that all? Yeah, you split off after the arrest, right?
Well, my father never liked doing business with Israel, and I had started doing some business with Israel. Neither did my brother. And I took that business with me. So I represented the Israeli dairy industry until eventually that fell apart because of some scandals in Israel. And, it's a story of subsequent disasters.
Now, when...
I still have a disaster going, and I worked on it today with... never mind.
What is the years when you're doing the business for yourself and your wife's working with you. Is that like the late 80s to the late 90s? Is that?
Yeah, not the very late 90s, but yeah.
Yeah, because you're interviewed in 96 for Bancroft College.
Yeah.
And
Bancroft Library.
Library, okay.
The Bancroft Library is the library at University of California, Berkeley, and the organization that did the book is called ROHO, the Regional Oral History Office.
Okay, now, you were not being asked to do retrospectives of your 60s art at that point, but this is the first time your history is being sought for, you know, that people want to hear your story.
Well, it's another strange little anecdote. I was being interviewed by an oral historian about a woman who I'd known, an artist named Shirley Trieste.
Did we mention her? It sounds familiar, but I don't think we said much about her.
I don't know. Anyway, Shirley was an old anarchist, and she was married to a guy named Frank Trieste, whose brother worked at KPFA, and
yes, we talked about him. We talked about
friends of ours, and she had died, but she was a good friend of my first wife's and also Rada, my daughter's. And so while they were interviewing me, the oral historian said, "My God, you're so interesting. We really need to do an oral history of you." So she pushed it, and that's how it happened.
And I noticed in reading that oral history, somebody, Paul, helped pay for it? A cousin or ex-wife's son or through the other guy? You know, you remember that?
You want to speculate or you want me to tell you?
Okay.
It's my daughter, Rada's brother by my first wife, who... He was the guy she ran off with.
Bill Buck?
Yes, Bill Buck's son, Paul.
Yeah. Okay, so the library needed money to get the tape recording equipment, I guess, right?
Well, no, they had tape recording equipment.
I mean the tape.
Wait a minute. He funded the Shirley Trieste oral history.
Well, why did they need money? What do you mean funded
they,
it?
Each oral history is funded.
And why do they need money if they've got the tape recorder?
Who pays the oral historian?
Oh, okay. The person doing good. Okay, the person doing the taping. That is...
Yeah, I mean, I did make them buy a better tape recorder.
Okay, so Paul paid for that woman to interview you.
He gave the... It's not that, you know, that precise. He gave money to the Bancroft Library, and they used it to do my oral history, yes.
Okay.
I mean, they have to, you know, it has to be transcribed. It's not just the oral historian. They have students doing the transcription.
Yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera.
So you're interviewed in that, and that gives you opportunity to talk about what I call you being the Forrest Gump of 20th century art, interfacing with so many different people that become famous or controversial. So when you were interviewed by that, did that make you think about all these connections and what you'd done in your life in a new way, or did you naturally remember these things and think about it throughout your life? Or did that bring it all back for you? What was the effect of that medium of being taped and looking back at your life, the detention on you?
Actually, I think I wasn't particularly happy with it. I think I could do a better job writing it, but I never did.
You mean you? Well, what was wrong with it?
It just you know,
too rambling.
First of all, she didn't. She was totally unfamiliar with the material, so second of all, their idea is that context is more important than, you know, a lot of the stuff is, when you're just talking, sequences get mixed up.
Yeah.
You know, so, and they don't want any editing. They want to use it the way it is. And you know, there were things that I would have liked to get rid of. There were some embarrassing, some things that would embarrass other people.
Yeah.
But, you know, I and as I said, she didn't, the persona that I was talking about, she's a feminist, and she's a nice lady, don't get me wrong, but she didn't get it. She was very happy to do it. It was work, and you know, her. She is a historian. She's a professor, but it just wasn't.
It's like you want it. You live a discontinuous art form. You present a discontinuous nonlinear.
And it was done in pieces. You know, I mean, I did some when I came out, and then I to San Francisco, and then the next time I came out. So it, yeah. Hey, it's there. You know, it's a work, and it exists. Like what you're doing exists.
Right. No, and it's a good.
I think a memoir is writing, and hopefully good writing. And if I wrote a few sections of a memoir, but I've never really sat down and done it seriously. If I ever do it, I'll do it, but I'm not sure that I will have the time left to do that.
Right, but and the pattern I'm seeing is that you do nonlinear art, but the story of your life you'd like to present in a more linear way.
I don't know if I want it more linear. I just want it more poetic.
Yeah, more adjectives, more connections, more pattern.
More texture. Yeah.
Right.
Right, yeah, you're right. More funky.
Yeah, which we're trying to do here. It may not be as good as written.
I don't know what we're doing. I don't feel bad about what we're doing. I feel okay about it.
Great. So the Bancroft, that's in 96, and you talk about you're with Sally, and seems to be okay, but then shortly after that, you and Sally separate.
Shortly after what?
After the Bancroft history, because that's in 96, and you're talking about being with Sally, and then when I met you a few years later, you weren't with Sally anymore.
Right.